I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Can baking bread bring you closer to a Zen state? I'll let you find out. Also, do you have a food snob in your midst? Or maybe you're one and don't know it yet. I've got some important info on symptoms. The birth mother of authentic Chinese food in LA is here. And how to live in the past by cooking from old recipes. But first, let's see what's in season at the area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's November, and people are excited about holidays, but one thing that people tend to overlook is that avocados tend to slip out of season in the November-December time frame. And suddenly people realize there's no avocados in the market, and everybody starts missing them. And we're talking now again with David Karp, who is the fruit detective, and he's going to explain to us a little bit about the avocado seasonality, and then let's talk about that special sort of rootstock, that weird little avocado that hardly anybody grows.
Yeah, this is about as far out of season as an avocado can get in general. If you look in commercial markets right now, most of what you're seeing is from Chile and from Mexico. And much of it has been artificially ripened with ethylene. And so it has that sort of weird liverish cast to it that I find unattractive. It's probably not unhealthy. But we're lucky here in farmers markets because we can get avocados 12 months of the year. There are two approaches you can get to avocados at this time of year. One is we can either get last year's crops. In that case, you have to go to all the way upstate to Morro Bay, where Mike Cerrone, many of us know him as Sea Canyon, has Morro Bay Hass avocados. They're so rich and oily, they're just mind-boggling, and they keep very well. You see, if you have a Hass from North San Diego County, the state's primary producing area, they will go from underripe to ripe to rancid in a matter of seconds.
Why is that?
Because it's so hot down there that they practically bake on the tree. So they're really overmatured. You can get better specimens from Ventura County, but the best of all are from further north coastal areas like Morro Bay.
Now, you're talking specifically at this time of year.
At this time
this
of
late
year.
In the season. Because they've been on the tree so long, the oil has been sitting in the avocado for so long that once they're picked that it can tend to go off really quickly.
Yes, but from Morro Bay, because it doesn't get as hot in that area, they're coastal, they keep very well. Now, there are certain avocados of this year's crop that actually are ready to eat. Now, Mud Creek Ranch and Laura Ramirez both have Mexicola, which looks sort of like an eggplant in terms of the coloration. It's pear-shaped. A couple things distinctive about that. You can eat the skin. It's so thin, and it also has a distinctive anise flavor. The leaves are very much appreciated in Mexican cooking. The avocado itself is, this is its season. They're never sold commercially. They're never shipped to the East Coast because they're so thin-skinned.
Okay, well, that sounds like something wonderful to try.
Now, what happened to those poor avocado growers? A lot of them lost their trees. They were burned. Huge, just a holocaust in terms of groves burning and fruit falling off the tree in the high winds. Production's going to be down 10 to 20% from people that I've spoken to. Mm-hmm. They're facing a triple whammy because they've got high labor prices. Worst of all, a lot of the growers are losing their water. And they have to forcibly cut back a third of the water. And you just can't do that. You have to basically fallow the grows, mm-hmm. meaning turn off the water, let the trees die, mm-hmm. which is just a horrific choice for these guys to be making.
It is.
I mean, a lot of them are going to say, look, I've got land worth X $100,000 an acre. It's going to search its better economic use, which is going to be housing.
Mm-hmm. All right, David. Well, as always, great to talk to you and to find out about the Mexicola avocado with this intriguing anise flavor and the edible skin. That just sounds like a wonderful thing to try. We are visiting now with Jean-François Metinier, who is the chef at La Cachette over in Century City, and we're asking him what he plans to do this fall with the inspiring pumpkins we see everywhere in the market.
Yeah, the pumpkin this year, actually, we just open them, take the seeds out, throw them in the oven, the whole thing, like for two and a half, 3 hours. When it's soft, you take it out, you puree it in a Cuisinart, and you have to put it in the strainer like for like 2 days to get rid of all the water. And at the last cooking class, we did a quiche, pumpkin quiche. It was delicious. And a pumpkin pie, but made with that fresh pumpkin puree and honey. Mm. Honey, a little bit of eggs, cream, and pumpkin puree.
Okay, and when you say put it in a strainer, you'd put it in a metal strainer or in cheesecloth? Or
a cheesecloth is good, too.
In the fridge over
in the
a
fridge
bowl?
For like 2 days.
2 days.
And make sure it's suspended like that the water stays on the bottom.
Oh, okay.
Actually, the juice, you can reduce it. And after, when it's reduced, it looks like honey.
And then you can cook with it?
You can. Yeah, we put a little bit of cream and we roll the raviolis in it.
Oh.
Yeah,
oh,
I know.
Wow. Oh. Now, what kind of pumpkins? Not the big jack-o'-lanterns. You use a little, they're called sugar bear or baby bear?
Yes, the little ones.
It looks like a little baby pumpkin, but it's an edible pumpkin.
It's delicious, very sweet. I was like, I don't know, pumpkin quiche sounds a little weird, but it was delicious.
Yeah, sounds delicious.
Very delicious.
Okay, so, and you'll share that recipe with us later?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. And you're going to be doing some of this holiday baking at the restaurant?
We're doing the pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving.
We should have a citywide pumpkin pie contest. Who has the best pumpkin pie?
Oh, yeah, that's that'd be fun, actually.
Let's do it. And Jean-Francois, you're doing something else special to help the writers through the tough times now with the strike.
Yeah, we came up with no charge at Valley Parking for lunch.
That's fantastic. Is that just for writers?
No, for everybody now.
That is fantastic.
Thank you.
That's so great. And tell us again, where is your restaurant?
Some Little Santa Monica Boulevard is right before Beverly Glen.
Thanks so much, Jean-Francois.
You're very welcome.
Be sure to join us this Thursday night, the 15th of November. We're going to have our final library panel of the year. This takes place at the Santa Monica Public Library in the beautiful Martin Luther King Auditorium. This week's panel is going to be lots of fun. It's called Guy's Night Out. It features Russ Parsons as moderator, Chef Rich Mead from Sage and Sage on the Coast in Newport Beach, and then two of our favorite farmers, Alex Weiser and Phil McGrath. It's going to be four guys up there talking about what inspires them about shopping at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. The panel goes from 7 till 9 p.m. It's free and open to the public. It takes place at the Santa Monica Main Library. That's at 6th and Santa Monica Boulevard. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Last week, we talked about how to make a garlic confit with 50 raw garlic cloves. One of our listeners, David Bunting, wrote to us with a warning about garlic-infused oil and its link to potentially fatal botulism. What you want to do with any oil-infused product that you make at home is make sure to add 1 tablespoon of vinegar per cup of oil and keep the finished product refrigerated. That's in the recipe online, but I just wanted to make sure to emphasize it more emphatically. If you have any questions, you can email me at goodfood@kcrw.com. Coming up next, the Brass Sisters, a charming pair of food historians who could bring the past back to life by cooking dishes from abandoned recipes. That's next on Good Food on KCRW. What is a recipe? A list of ingredients and directions for throwing it all together, perhaps. But in time, some recipes take on lives of their own. Our next guests, Marilyn and Sheila Brass, have a huge collection of heirloom recipes which have transcended the ingredients and become living histories of the people who created them. The Brass Sisters are here to share some of these stories with us. Welcome, ladies.
Hi, this is Marilyn.
And this is Sheila.
What are heirloom recipes and where do you discover them?
Well, this is Marilyn, and I am going to just jump in right here, Evan. Actually, it's part of our own history because we started collecting kitchen antiques, culinary antiques, about 30 years ago. You know, beautiful mixing bowls, wonderful egg beaters, potato ricers, and about 20 years ago, after going to yard sales, we noticed that there was always a cardboard box in the kitchen or the basement, the cellar or the attic, but mostly in the kitchen. And Sheila will tell you what we found there.
We found scraps of paper. We found little composition books, the old black and white ones, the little dots. And they were full of handwritten recipes.
We refer to those as manuscript cookbooks. And we refer to the single scraps of handwritten paper as living recipes.
How old are some of these? Give us an idea of the eras that you have been collecting.
This is Sheila, and the oldest one is from the French and Indian War.
Wow.
Which makes it old.
Really old.
Really old. But the majority are like the latter part of the 19th century and up until the 70s.
Were people happy to have you sort of rescue them since they were just going to die in obscurity somewhere?
I have to give a resounding yes to that. This is Marilyn, and I'm so excited to be talking about these. It seemed that when we went to these yard sales, and we were really, really into yard sales, Evan, we were going to like 30 or 40 on a Saturday. People would say to us, you know, just take these. We don't have any use for them, but we just don't want to throw them out. And we treasured them because not only were they full of recipes, they really told a story about the women and some men who had collected the recipes. So it really was a culinary education for us, too.
And this is Sheila. And we also found a love letter.
You found a love letter?
We found a love letter. And Marilyn can tell you about that.
Well, the love letter was in a manuscript cookbook that was actually falling apart as we handled it. And it was from, I believe, To Helen from John, and it was from 1897, Worcester, Massachusetts. He referred to her as his darling, dear little girl. So it was quite touching. And we actually have tried two of Helen's recipes. One of them are for fried cheese balls. They're almost like this wonderful crab cake, only it doesn't have any crab in it. And we serve it with a chili mayonnaise. And the other one is like a potatoes Anna, but it's made with sweet potatoes. So we refer to it as potatoes Helen. So Helen's name is going to be carried on in a culinary tradition.
Okay, now I have to ask you about a recipe. What about the recipe for sweet potato pie from North Carolina?
That is Lanny's Lord Have Mercy sweet potato pie. And this was given to me by a coworker. It was her grandmother's recipe. And the title came from the fact that anyone who took a forkful of it just closed their eyes, lifted their eyes to heaven, and said, Lord, have mercy. It was just so wonderful, so good. And we made it, and it's just heavenly.
Now, this is Marilyn, and I once again want to add a little something. You can tell we're sisters. This recipe makes two pies. And that's really great, especially for the Thanksgiving holidays or any holidays. And the good news is that Mrs. Edmondson, Lanny, her story is now perpetuated. She was a wonderful baker, and she taught her granddaughter, Yvette, how to bake. And we also have another recipe in our book for grandmother's secret banana pudding. And that's equally as delicious. These two recipes are African American. And I'll tell you, we're two Jewish Yankees, and we love Lanny's Lord Have Mercy sweet potato pie.
Now, let me ask you, what makes you want to just stand up and scream, Lord Have Mercy? Describe what the pie tastes like.
First of all, this is Marilyn. It's creamy, and it uses sweet potatoes, and it has molasses in it.
Cinnamon.
And cinnamon. And as far as I'm concerned, cream is one of the four major food groups. We used Sheila's pie crust recipe. Sheila's recipe is very flaky. So when you add flaky pie crust to a wonderful, sweet, creamy custard filling, and perhaps, you know, gild the lily with a dollop of vanilla flavored whipped cream. How bad can life be?
And this is Sheila. And I want to tell you that as rich as it is, that's how light it is. So if you've had a great big Thanksgiving dinner, a piece of this pie will be perfect because it is very light.
Now, you talk about women sweet-talking.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
we're doing it right now.
We're doing it right now. When women get together and they discuss desserts, they're sweet-talking.
Thank you so much.
Happy Thanksgiving and have fun baking.
Heirloom Baking is Marilyn and Sheila Brass's book. They hail from Boston. I've got more info and links on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. It is the month of the turkey.
a bird we don't think too much of the rest of the year. There are ingredients and flavors from all over Asia that work unbelievably well with this sometimes bland poultry. I'll be back in just a moment with Savoir magazine editor James Osland. That's when Good Food continues. Some of us use Thanksgiving to reinforce old family traditions. The same dishes are found on the table every year. But there are others, courageous culinary adventurers, who are looking for the new, the purely delicious. For those, we bring you Savoir editor James Osland and the Asian-themed Thanksgiving. So have you ever really done this? Invited a bunch of people over and then confronted them with an Asian-themed Thanksgiving?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely have. I think my friends and family would expect nothing less of me.
You have very accepting people.
I do.
What are some of the flavors that you play with when it comes to the turkey?
Well, I found this really wonderful thing. I've tried it out twice, where rather than doing this saltwater pre-marinade, this brining of turkeys that's so, so popular these days, I've tried this thing where I take a bit of black soy sauce, which is to say soy sauce that's been brewed a little bit longer than the normal soy sauce that we're familiar with, and it has a sweeter, more molassesy, deeper, richer taste.
It's almost like the balsamic vinegar version of soy sauce.
Absolutely. That's a really beautiful way of describing it, exactly. And so what I'll do is I'll marinate a turkey, and I'm not going to want one of those monster turkeys. I'm going to want a manageable-sized turkey. And a bit of that, splash of Worcestershire sauce, a few whole star anise pods, a few sticks of nice fresh cinnamon, some black pepper. I'll stuff inside of it some small Asian shallots, and I'll let that marinate out at room temperature for a good few hours before roasting it. Whoa, it's delicious.
And it must make the skin this amazing burnished color.
Absolutely, truly, truly mahogany beauty.
Yum. And then what do you use as a dressing?
What I've been doing the last few times that I did that was I've stuffed it with nothing more than these wonderful Asian variety of shallots that you'll find at Asian markets. I stuff it like chock-a-block in the cavity as well as around the pan. And that's all I'm using. But, however, you could stuff a turkey like this with the traditional stuffing. And maybe to give it more of an Asian zing, a really nice ingredient might be some candied ginger.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, right. Julienne into the finest slivers. You wouldn't want to go overboard with it, but just enough to give it this subtly sweet, spicy zing.
Since here in L.A., we have so many really incredible Asian markets. I mean, Korean markets, Chinese markets, Japanese markets,
so
Thai markets.
The best in the country,
really?
Hands down. Oh, absolutely.
And when I walk through them, I'm like a kid in a candy store. I mean, you just like, because half the time you can't read the labels, so you just start taking stuff, filling your basket, and you take them home and smell everything. It's like, what do I do with this? So do you have any ideas for some great ingredients we can find at our local Asian markets that would complement a Thanksgiving dinner?
You know, it's funny because even if I'm cooking, say, more Western, more traditional Thanksgiving fare, there's something about going into a Western supermarket at holiday time that kind of throws me into an anxiety attack. I'm kind of like, where's the Xanax? This is TMI for me. But when I go into an Asian market, I'm instantly inspired. Like, none of the shackles of what I think I have to cook are there with me in my mind, holding me down. And instead, I'm like, whoa, long beans, long beans instead of green beans in a green bean casserole. And maybe rather than the Campbell's cream of mushroom soup, maybe I'll make a kind of bechamel and I'll use some beautiful dried shiitake mushrooms slivered in it.
Could you describe what long beans are and how the flavor's a little different from green beans?
Long beans are usually about a foot and a half to 2 feet long. They're about pencil width, and they have a really lovely, earthy, deep green, rich flavor. I'm a great fan of green beans, don't get me wrong, but long beans are really an extraordinary ingredient. There are two main varieties that we'll find in Asian markets. One is sort of pale green, a more lime green kind of color, and another is a deeper forest green color.
What about poultry? Because when I think of Asian markets, I think of alternatives to turkeys, like maybe ducks, for example.
Oh, absolutely. And you couldn't do better to find a terrific duck or a chicken in an Asian market, especially in Southern California. But some of the ducks that you'll find in Asian markets, really, really exquisite, wonderful, fresh, sweet, fatty things. And the same goes for the chickens as well. Free-range, terrific chickens, very meaty, beautiful birds. And the prices are just insanely good.
Do you have any Asian ideas for us for a Thanksgiving dessert?
You know, it might be nice. A red rice pudding. And what you'd do with that is you'd get some red rice. You'd boil it with water. Toward the end of the process, the cooking process, when the rice really starts to soften and turn glutinous and wonderful, you add sugar, pinch of salt. Serve it in bowls, and just before serving, drizzle it with a bit of rich, thick coconut milk. It's different than pumpkin pie, but just as delicious, I guarantee.
Thank you, James.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
James Osland is the editor of Savoir Magazine. His Asian-inspired turkey ideas are online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Cooking can be a meditative experience. It can be one of the only things to calm me down after a stressful day of, well, cooking. The practice of Zen meditation is another way to truly let go. Combine it with cooking and you encounter a lot of rules and precise ways to make motions and hold your hands. Practitioners find that this attention to detail allows the brain to let go and experience true meditation. When Good Food returns, I'll introduce you to a Zen priest and baker. Stay tuned. I remember the first time I opened the Tassajara bread book. It was another time. I was so young. And yet it's like yesterday that I realized others had the same kinship with food, the same peace preparing it that I had. In a way, that book gave me permission to follow this road that I've been on for more than 30 years. The man who essentially gave me that permission is Edward S.B. Brown, a Zen priest who's been teaching at the San Francisco Zen Center's Tassajara, Green Gulch, and City Center. He also teaches meditation and cooking classes all over the world. Well, there's now a movie documenting Brown's teaching and philosophy. It's called How to Cook Your Life. It opens in theaters Friday, November 16th. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, your teacher, Suzuki Roshi, gave you some very interesting advice on cooking. Could you sort of paraphrase that for us or share it with us?
Well, you know, when you make food, you're definitely putting yourself into it. You know, the suggestion or encouragement in Zen practice is you make a sincere, honest effort and let it go.
Do you think that it's possible to do that, for example, when you're about to cook Thanksgiving dinner for a big, critical family?
You know, sometimes it's more possible or less possible, but I think it's certainly possible. Or part of what we're talking about here is you have an aim. You know, your aim is to make a sincere, thorough effort and, you know, let people have the experience they have. You may or may not hit the mark, but you keep aiming for it.
You have this sort of marvelous meditation on your website about eating and about the idea of more, how our brains are constantly wanting more, even when our mouths are full.
Well, that's, you know, that's not always the case, but it's certainly a human tendency to somehow, no matter what our experience is, to, you know, want it to be different it is. So they actually say, there's actually a Zen teaching that supreme perfect enlightenment is to meet somebody for the first time and not think about whether or not you like them. It also says it's like viewing flowers or the moon and not wishing for even more color or brightness. And in food that comes up, it's curiously enough, and a friend of mine who's a Vipassana teacher talked at one point about how his son, when his son was little, like, I don't know, you know, 3 years old or 2 years old, and he had a strawberry in each hand and a strawberry in his mouth and a bowl of strawberries in front of him. And when his father took away the bowl of strawberries, he started crying because the bowl of strawberries was taken away.
That's sort of like us at midnight with ice cream.
Yeah.
Or a big bag of potato chips.
Yeah. Well, I am. It's helped me to experience things closely, you know, and to be honest. And when I do that, I find that having more doesn't help me satisfy what I'm somehow longing to satisfy. You know, I have some longing for a kind of satisfaction or nourishment or fulfillment, and more food doesn't help.
Do you still drink coffee while you're meditating?
Sometimes. You're referring to, in case people don't know, but, you know, at the Zen Center for many years, I've, of course, practiced meditation. We don't have coffee in the meditation hall. But at home, when I sit, I often sit first thing in the morning with a cup of coffee. And, you know, my homeopath told me to stop drinking coffee. And so I did for almost a year. But I felt so happy when I started drinking it again.
Oh, that's really nice to know.
And then she said, oh, well, maybe it's okay. You know, the homeopaths in Europe don't worry about people drinking coffee as much as the homeopaths here in America. And so I've gotten dispensation to have coffee again. But, you know, and I just talked to a friend like this, and she said, oh, I haven't been meditating lately. I said, you haven't? No, and she says, no, I sit in bed with my coffee and drink my coffee. And I said, but you could combine the coffee with the sitting, because I know it's hard to have time for both. You know, if you take time to have your coffee, you may as well be meditating while you have your coffee, because, you know, it's hard to fit everything in a day.
Is that called Zen multitasking?
I think of it as, that's maybe so, Zen multitasking. But I also think of it as practical. And I find it just very focusing, you know, and very helpful for me. When I get distracted, I have a sip of coffee, and I have, you know, I have the cup preheated, and the coffee's hot, and the milk is hot, and then I have a lid for the coffee, so it stays hot. And then I can sip at it, you know, when I get distracted, and then I can savor the coffee. And then the kind of meditation we do is like, give your attention to each thing. So when you have a sip of coffee, you're actually meditating with that. You're savoring the coffee and the flavor and taste of the coffee, and you receive that.
Edward S.B. Brown is a Zen Buddhist priest and author of the Tassajara Bread Book. He holds meditation and cooking classes around the world, including at the Tassajara Zen Center in Northern California. The film How to Cook Your Life begins its run on Friday, November 16th at the Sunset 5. I've got all the details online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Food is a perfect vehicle for expressing your religion. What you eat is totally within your control, and what you eat or don't eat can say an awful lot about you, which is why I can find some overly judgmental vegetarians a bit tiresome. I mean, I'm an educated person in the food industry. I get it. But I cook food for a living, and like it or not, the world still eats meat. I have to deal with all eaters. So when I heard about two young guys podcasting about food with the simple adage, we don't cook meat, I knew I had to meet them. I'll introduce them to you next. That's when Good Food continues. Any guys who tell me that they believe in cheap groceries and high alcohol content beers are guys I want to meet. So let me introduce you to Alex Brown and Evan George, the Hot Knives. Welcome to Good Food, you guys.
Thanks, Evan.
It's nice to be here.
Who are you? Where did you come from? What do you do? Just to start off.
We run a food blog on a blogging community called Urban Honking, which is based in Portland, Oregon. We're both vegetarians, and we make vegetarian and vegan recipes. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Evan's from Washington, D.C.
Have you two, either of you two or both of you together, ever worked in a kitchen?
This is Alex. We both have some line cook experience.
If you name a scruffy coffee house on the northeast side of L.A., we've probably worked there, whether it's the Downbeat or Coffee Table or
Backdoor Bakery.
I love it. This is sort of like young, scruffy male coffee talk.
Yeah. Exactly.
Fantastic. Now, one thing that I find interesting is that you combine vegetarianism and beer. And I just say that because, you know, interviewing a million people as I have, there often seems to be a connection with making the choice to forego meat and also trying to be pure in other ways. Mm. So I have to say that I admire your verve.
We are definitely not straight edge.
It's something that's sort of always been, strangely enough, it's been a natural connection. A lot of our friends are vegetarians and vegans, and most of our friends are beer drinkers over wine drinkers.
So for a minute, I've been thinking about how a lot of avocado trees were incinerated over the past couple weeks. Mm-hmm. Sad, huh? Mm-hmm.
Really sad.
And I went on your blog and I saw this really incredible sort of homage to the avocado that was probably written before it was really an homage. But let's talk about avocados for a minute. I love that you refer to the bag of Trader Joe's avocados because that seems to be everyone's fallback position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I generally stick with Haas. Lately, we've experimented a little bit, and Alex can talk about the baby's head-sized avocado that we recently experimented with.
Those are amazing.
They're really, really wonderful. There's well over 500 different varietals, most of which are actually grown in California, which is amazing. And a lot of them don't have cute names like, you know, like Bacon and Haas and things like that. A lot of them are like XP17 and things like that.
Just so we know what we're talking about, describe what a Haas looks like. Is it pebbly or is it smooth?
They're smaller. They're probably about the size of a clenched fist. They turn very, very dark, almost black on the skin when they ripen. And they're not smooth at all. They're nice and bumpy. The one that we got recently that was in the picture on the blog.
The picture's extraordinary because just the slices of it show how enormous it was.
It was very, very big. And we got it from what was it? It was called like Guacamole Heaven or Holy Guacamole.
Holy Guacamole.
Yeah, we got it from those guys in the East Pasadena Farmers Market. And they were saying that these were the biggest bacons of the season and they were the last bacons of the season.
And so are those a smooth skin variety?
Yes. Very, very, very light green on the outside. Almost no bumps at all. And when I've had them before, they've been different textures. And sometimes they're so, so soft on the inside and the skin is so thin that it's really hard to peel them and make them look pretty.
So what I'd like to do now is have you simulate your blog. Mm-hmm. Give me a recipe. Give me a beer pairing and a music pairing, which you do so well.
Mm-hmm. This is Evan. We are getting ready for winter months. Hopefully, it's going to start getting colder. And what we usually break out in November is a vegan gravy. We always use mushroom to replace the beefiness of a meat gravy. And one of our favorite mushroom varieties is oyster mushrooms. So in a large soup pot, start with either vegan butter, margarine. We use Earth Balance. Find it's pretty awesome. Or you can do half that and half olive oil. Hit it with a head of garlic, some shallots, 8 to 10 ounces of oyster mushrooms, and then douse it in cream sherry, just a cheap sherry. Let it reduce by half. And then we usually hit it with a mushroom stock, season as you like it, basically, and a little bit of soy milk to give it creaminess. It's a recipe we use all the time and that you can find on the blog for more specifics.
In terms of beer, I mean, we, for a gravier vibe, you know, we like to...
More umami.
More umami, yes. The winter months usually sort of see us getting really, really excited about, you know, the big, heavy beers.
Pick one beer for the recipe.
Koenig Chauvin Quadruple was a beer that we've drank under a different label called La Trappe. But it's a beautiful, you know, 13 to 14% beer. Really, really malty and sweet. But it's not so overpoweringly sweet that you can't eat it with food. It rounds out the really, really thick aspects of like a gravy-based dish. But it also sort of, it plays a little bit with the sherry or what's left of the sherry because it's aged in casks.
Yum. It looks quite beautiful, the picture that you have on your website. Mm. And music?
Most of the time whenever we're making gravy, it's for brunch, actually, because we'll make Evan's girlfriend Megan has this sourdough starter that's about 4 generations old. And we'll make these fantastic sourdough biscuits to serve with the gravy. And usually when it's brunch time, we're listening to like the Velvet Underground.
Yeah, I mean, soundtracks for us are more about what makes sense with the cooking rather than the food itself, because pairing it with food is kind of silly. But in terms of vibe of cooking a gravy, I would say, you know, Velvet Underground, Sunday morning, pretty good selection.
Perfect. Thank you so much, you guys. It's been really, really fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alex Brown and Evan George are former line cooks who don't cook with meat. They've got a blog and a video cast absolutely worth checking out. If you go to kcrw.com/goodfood, you can find links to their stuff. Can I really follow a segment on vegetarians with one on pork sandwiches? I think I can, and I will. The best of the sandwich made with pork. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW. It's no secret that certain foods have the ability to inspire passion that verges on the obsessive. Pork, for example, is famous for capturing the attention of many good eaters. And Laurel Fantuzzo is no exception. A freelance writer with the Associated Press, Laurel went on her own personal odyssey to search for the nirvana of pork sandwiches. Hi, Laurel. Tell us what inspired you to go on a pork sandwich hunt.
Well, when I was about 7, I experienced my first serving of lechon. And lechon is a whole roasted pig. And my mother's from the Philippines. And when, you know, someone Filipino has a big celebration, say the birth of a baby or a wedding, they serve lechon. I was a little weirded out by it at first because it's whole. It looks like it's going to get up and talk to me. It's just very vivid. And I... you know, sampled a little bit of it, and there were no adjectives to describe how delicious it was. I kind of wanted to synthesize pork sandwiches across the cultures.
So what are some of the similarities that you found all these pork sandwiches across all these different cultures had in common?
Well, they all seem to appear either in the late 19th century or the early 20th century. The Cuban was purportedly invented in Florida as a 15-cent cheap lunch to immigrant workers in cigar factories. The Cuban has, you know, pickles in it and roast pork, and it's a melty, beautiful Swiss cheese, crusty bread mess.
Man, they're so good, Cuban sandwiches.
Yeah, they're delicious.
Now, what about the croque monsieur? First of all, do we have any idea why it's called that? Which I guess what would the translation be?
Well, it's kind of mysteriously translated as crunchy mister.
I love that.
Nobody's quite sure why.
What are its hallmarks, the croque monsieur?
Well, that's just a fat square of white bread that's toasted, and then it has a thick slice of ham with usually Gruyere cheese.
Now, of course, there's the famous Vietnamese sandwich, the banh mi. Could you describe what's inside a banh mi?
Yeah, this is probably my favorite sandwich. It's a beautiful, colorful sandwich. It has pickled daikon, which is white radish, inside. It has pickled carrots and fresh sprigs of cilantro, and sometimes it has a lot of sliced peppers for some extra kick. And there's shredded roast pork and just this rich pork pate that just nests beneath all the veggies inside this crusty baguette. And so when you bite into it, there's a lot of texture to it, and there's a lot of crunch and softness and, you know, sweet and savory, and it's lovely.
Are all of these pork sandwiches, do they tend to be priced at a level that anybody can approach them?
Yeah, they're sort of the people's sandwich. I know the banh mi that I love in New York City's Chinatown, it's actually served at the back of a jewelry store, and it kind of feels a little illicit, and it's at only $3.25, so that's, you know, it's kind of like a steal. Most of them barely break $5.
I love
that. So it makes them really accessible. Yeah.
Yeah, pork should definitely be open to everyone. And now, what about the just traditional U.S. version, which I guess would be a pulled pork sandwich?
In North Carolina, it's a specialty, and competition for the best pork barbecue is just so fierce that each region has its own style, you know, east, west, north, south. And there's one little shack in eastern North Carolina that's only been owned by two families since 1938. It's called Bun's Barbecue. And it turns out these pulled pork sandwiches that are each only $2, and it has this regional vinegar pepper sauce. It can be served on just regular hamburger bun, but usually customers ask for two slabs of homemade cornbread, and they're just the meat's all pressed in between those two slices of cornbread.
All of these seem like they're kind of a mess.
Yeah, a beautiful mess.
That's great. Now, I understand that you reached pork sandwich nirvana in the Philippines. Why was that?
Well, I was there with an educational program, and with that program, we visited the Ifugao province, which is in the north, and that's where they do a lot of rice harvests. And we were invited to a rice harvest, but to participate, we had to provide them with a whole pig. And we weren't really sure what was going to happen with the pig, but it turns out that we had to attend a live pig slaughter. And part of the ceremony was that we had to watch the pig being slaughtered and then, you know, watch it be barbecued and then eat it.
When you realized that all this was going to happen, did you want to run away?
I knew I wasn't going to be comfortable, but at the same time, I felt like I'm such a lifelong devotee of pork that I really should see where it comes from. And I don't think you're going to find a more respectable way of slaughtering a pig than the Ifugao, because part of the gesture of slaughtering their pig is that they put a rice stalk in the mouth of the pig after it's dead to wish it an abundant life in heaven. So I really liked that gesture of thanking the pig for, you know, providing its meat to us.
And then how is it cooked?
It was actually boiled. It's cooked over an open flame, and then they have a big pot that they put over the flame with water in it, and they boiled it. And then they served it to us.
And what was the vehicle? What was the starch vehicle that held the pieces of pork?
Well, the other specialty in the Ifugao province besides the pork is fresh baked banana bread. So I actually put the pork between the banana bread and ate it that way.
And what was that like, this combination of the savory pork with the sweet banana bread? That sounds like heaven.
Well, the banana bread was really, really dense.
Well, thank you for coming and sharing your personal odyssey with pork with us.
Sure. Thank you very much, Evan.
Laurel Fantuzzo is a freelance writer living in New York. Some of the LA spots with pork sandwiches will be on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Knowing what a good pork sandwich tastes like doesn't make you a food snob, but knowing the correct names for all the pork sandwiches served across the world might be an indication that you're in the company of a food snob. I'll tell you more about this intense creature in just 30 seconds. That's when Good Food at KCRW continues. Raffinage, zest, fennel pollen, and sous vide. Quickly, go ahead, give me the definitions. Can you do it? If not, then maybe you need the Food Snobs Dictionary, a witty compendium of reference terms for the food obsessive, or for those who'd like to be able to understand that cultish foodie in your life. David Camp and Marion Rosenfeld co-authored this perfect stocking stuffer. Hi, guys.
Hello, Evan.
Hello.
So your book seems to have a dual purpose. What are these two purposes?
Well, first of all, I think it's to equip the layman with these terms. You know, we've come – suddenly menu language has changed and we're hearing about fennel pollen and cardoons and fair trade and free range and grass-fed. And I think sometimes the layman sees such menus and doesn't know what to make of them. And so this book will serve, you know, as a helpful tool in decoding that. It also will help the trainee food snob who actually wants to lord this knowledge over other people. You know, it's sort of like, you know, Cliff's Notes prepping you for your bull sessions with other food snobs.
Okay, let's get into the dictionary. What are some hints you can give us for using it?
Well, there are some helpful sidebars of, you know, the films that every food snob must claim to have seen. There's a pronunciation guide, so you know it's Danielle Boulou instead of Danielle Boulud, you know, that sort of thing. And then it is meant to be a fun, handy-dandy reference where you can open any given page and just pick up something that you can then deploy in a dinner party conversation that night. Oh, yes, of course I know what compost tea is.
Is that a really delicious beverage?
Compost tea is actually something I learned about from visiting vineyards. It's just a kind of way of treating plants, vines, whatever, with non-chemical pesticides, essentially. You make a tea out of compost. You add water to nasty things like fish heads and whatever else you might throw into a compost. And this somehow serves as a sort of all-natural pesticide.
If you could only give us three chefs that we absolutely have to know about to be considered a food snob, who would they be?
I would say, for one, Heston Blumenthal. He's an Englishman. He has a place out in the English countryside called the Fat Duck, which is very food forward, and it also uses a lot of offal, O-F-F-A-L.
Ferran Adria.
Yeah.
Mr. Molecular Gastronomy, 1990, 2000, and beyond. He's the one who popularized foams, for example, and all the science experiments in the kitchen.
Not that we necessarily like foams. We call them a sputum-like nuisance in the book. But we do give Adria credit for being, you know, the king of molecular gastronomy. And I would say a third chef, it's not a wacky offbeat choice, but Thomas Keller of the French Laundry in Yountville, California, and also Per Se in Manhattan. He is just the king of all chefs, the most revered. And I think referencing Thomas, especially calling him by his first name, and Thomas does it this way, you know, that's sort of the ultimate.
Okay, so let's have you give me some definitions. I'm going to throw out a word and you define it. Affinage.
A place to age cheeses.
Wow, that is so arcane.
Yeah, but the arcane is becoming chic again, you know? It's the idea that, you know, I'm going to do my own stuff. I'm going to go back to the old ways, which is a very food snobby stance these days. You know?
I'll probably get bad emails saying that because I said I thought it was arcane.
What, you don't have your own cheese cave? What's your problem?
Tell me about Dirty Girl Produce.
Dirty Girl Produce is just, it's actually, it fits in larger with the idea of this Ferry Place Farmer's Market, which is this, I think it's sort of the mecca for food snobbery in San Francisco. It's this indoor market that also has an outdoor farmer's market component to it. And it has all these stalls operated by these sort of snob brand names, which aren't the brand names you see in supermarket like Kraft and Crest toothpaste, but brand names like, you know, Nyman Ranch Beef and Acme Bread Company. And Dirty Girl Produce fits into that. It's a Santa Cruz, California fruit and vegetable supplier whose wares have just been fetishized by food snobs, especially in Northern California. But it's the mark of a food snob even on the East Coast that you actually know, oh, yes, of course, Dirty Girl Produce, they have far superior stuff than you get in the supermarkets out there.
So do you have any faux food snobbery?
Absolutely. I mean, we do have lists. We do have a list of things that civilians think are food snobbish, but in fact aren't. I'd say the foremost example would be truffle oil. People hear about truffle oil and they think, ooh, that must be fancy. You know, they'll see that some pasta or some kind of a pizza blanca without, you know, tomato sauce is drizzled with truffle oil. Most truffle oil that you get in America is, in fact, chemical compound stuff that's artificial. And, you know, real truffle oil is, in fact, quite rare, which is simply olive oil that's been infused with truffle shavings. So it sort of puts one over on the mere civilian.
Let's end this on films. I was so happy to see that you had a filmography for Food Snobs. Give me your top three.
Well, my first, I'd say, is Babette's Feast.
Oh, the best.
Just because that the whole premise of that film is that, you know, it's going to end, climax. Instead of a car chase or a steamy sex scene, it's a big dinner, you know, and it's all like it's all leading up to that. And I just think that everyone who has a PBS or National Public Radio tote bag just, you know, exulted in that sexy food climax of that movie.
And for me, it was Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. I mean, that dim sum just popped out of the screen. I didn't really care about the story of the sisters.
Well, you saw the 3D version, didn't you?
Now in Food Around. That was just beautiful.
And I would say Tom Jones with Albert Finney, just because it's not commonly thought of as a food snob movie. But that, again, conflates the gastronomical and the sexual in this very cinematic way that it really speaks to why food snobs become food snobs, because it is their sex.
Yeah, food pornography.
Exactly.
Well, this has been really fun. Thank you to both of you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
David Camp and Marianne Rosenfeld have penned the Food Snobs Dictionary, an essential lexicon of gastronomical knowledge. It's a fun read if you happen to be a self-confessed foodie or maybe live with one. Just a note, there's an intriguing food and wine festival taking place today and tomorrow in Palm Desert. It's called The Art of Food and Wine Palm Desert and features art, food, and wine education. Chefs like David Rosengarten, Gail Gand, and Rick Tremonto will be there. Go to artoffoodandwine.com or our site at kcrw.com/goodfood for details. Southern California has the most sophisticated Chinese cuisine outside of mainland China, but it wasn't always this way. In 1961, the only thing Americans knew about Chinese food was something called egg foo young. All that has changed, and the person who changed it is my next guest, the woman behind the Mandarin restaurants, when Good Food returns. For many of us brought up in L.A. or San Francisco, a visit to the Mandarin was a rite of passage. It was a special occasion restaurant where the food was a revelation, and we all knew that a remarkable woman had created it all during an era where women in the kitchen or running a restaurant was quite unusual. Cecilia Chang has finally written a book, along with Lisa Weiss, that's part memoir, part cookbook. She's here with us this morning. I guess I would have to start by asking you to tell us what life was like for you as a child in Beijing.
Well, as you know, I'm grown up in a big family. We have 12 children by the same parents, no concubine. 9 girls and 3 boys. So I'm the number 7 daughter in the family. And my mother was very strict and keep telling us when we were little, always said, everybody should get along and the harmony. And I had a, I think, wonderful childhood.
Explain to me the position of food in your house. There were so many girls. Were you allowed to help in the kitchen?
No, not at all. Because all the cooks are males or men. We're not supposed to go in the kitchen. Only my mother sometimes and went in there and teach them how to cook and give her some private recipes.
So I would imagine that your family was quite wealthy then if you had cooks in your home.
Yeah, we have 2 cooks because we are from Shanghai, south of China. And their food is quite different compared with northern Chinese food. So we have two cooks, one cook northern style. In Beijing, we eat a lot of like bread, noodles, pastas. So quite different with Shanghai dishes. Shanghai dishes, mainly the food is rice. And all the food has a little touch of sweetness. But my both parents, they love food, and also they know food, and they know how to enjoy good food. That's the way we brought up. So I think I got a lot of influence from my mother.
What led you to the west coast of the United States, to San Francisco?
I have a sister. No, we all call numbers because too many sisters. Number six sister, and her name is Sophie. And she married ABC. They settled down in San Francisco. But just after she got married, her husband died of cancer. So I came here, tried to comfort her, see what she needs.
And did you end up never leaving?
When I came here to visit her, one day, by coincidence, ran into a couple lady friends from Tokyo. They wanted to open a Chinese restaurant, asked me to negotiate in the lease. So I did. I got the lease. I paid the deposit, and they back out. So I got stuck with $10,000. And so finally, I said, oh boy, this is a lot of money, you know, and I better do something. So I decided to open a restaurant. And also, that time, whenever we go have Chinese food, it's always chop suey and the egg foo young and the chow mein and nothing else. And they were all quite busy, you know. I said, this is Chinese food. I never heard of those things called egg foo young or something like that. So I said, I have to do something. I want to let American know chop suey and egg foo young is really not Chinese food. You know, I have to educate them. So I opened the first Mandarin on Polk Street. It's really just a hurricane called a little hole in the wall, only seating about 60 people. Fortunately, it was very successful.
Well, thank you so much, Mrs. Chang. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
The Seventh Daughter, My Culinary Journey from Beijing to San Francisco, is the memoir about Cecilia Chang's life. There's more information online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info on today's show and watch the latest videos of Good Food and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. This show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Charlton Thorpe. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.